Well, good morning. I'm State Representative Dave Pinto, the chair of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee, and I call this meeting to order pursuant to House Rule 10.01, which allows for virtual hearings. A welcome to members and members of the public. A reminder to members of the public that our meeting materials for this meeting of the Early Childhood Committee are posted to our committee website. You can find them there. They've also been emailed to members and staff as well. And so with that, we will start by having the clerk take the roll. Please, Ms. Chambers.
Yes, Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Pryor, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Dabney.
Present.
Representative Damon.
Present.
Representative Juergens.
Present.
Representative Cotiza Watoon.
Present.
Representative Morrison. Representative Wozlowick.
Present.
Representative Wolgamott.
Present.
And we have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Chambers. I know that Representative Morrison will be joining us just a few minutes late. She had another obligation, so look forward to having her. And we're very happy to have Representative Cotiza Watoon have a guest with us as well, as we do sometimes as well. We're going to move to quickly reviewing several sets of minutes. I'm going to rely on our Vice Chair, Representative Pryor, again, just to assist with that. Representative Pryor, could you please move approval of the minutes from January 26th, 2021?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So moved.
Thank you. And any members, any additions or corrections to those minutes? And seeing and hearing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes from January 26th, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? And so hearing none, the motion prevails, and the minutes from January 26th are adopted. And then moving to the minutes from January 28th, Representative Pryor, if you would.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Representative Pryor moves approval of the minutes from January 28th. Any additions or corrections, members? And again, hearing none, all in favor of approval of those minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Aye. Okay, so the motion again prevails and the minutes from January 28th are adopted. And so members, and thank you, Representative Pryor. Members and members of the public, just to sort of review where we are here, we have confirmed in this committee through several presentations, something that I hope we all would be aware of anyway, not just through our decision to be on this committee, but beyond that, that the first few years are absolutely critical to everything that comes later, including everything else that we're doing at the legislature. We've gotten that confirmed. We know that parents and guardians are the child's best, first and most important teachers. And that support for the family is just absolutely critical. And we reviewed some of that as well. But we also know because of the structure of the economy that that parents work and the parents are not necessarily with the child at all times. And so what we're in the middle of right now is getting an answer to a question that was raised by Representative Bennett, I think maybe about a week ago. Which is why is it then that that early care and learning is so expensive for families, and yet, as we've learned in previous presentations, the people who do this work are certainly not getting rich off it. In fact, sometimes the opposite. Whereas I think the question was, where does that extra money go? We heard on Thursday from an economist at the University of Minnesota talking about the squeeze on families and how we really ask the most of parents when they have the least is how that was put, and talking about what a challenging economic situation parents of young kids are in, just looking, stepping back and looking societally. Today, we're gonna look at things more from the workforce perspective and from providers of early care and learning and child care and early learning. And look at things from that angle as well. I'm really excited about that. I'm hoping that members of you found this this last few weeks pretty helpful as well. And so with that, we're going to start. I believe that Ms. Anders is starting us off. So I'm going to ask Krista Anders to identify herself for the record, and then please proceed, and then we'll move on to the remaining presenters. Ms. Anders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and all of the other members for this opportunity to be with you here this morning. My name is Krista Anders, and I serve as the coordinator of Transforming Minnesota's Early Childhood Workforce. And I am joined this morning with two of my colleagues, Jamie Bonsick, who is the executive director of the Hopkins Early Learning Center, with almost two decades of experience in early childhood, and Oriane Casal, who is the interim director of the Labor Market Information Office with the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. And Oriane also has two decades of experience at DEED. So Oriane and I are going to give a high-level overview of the industry in crisis, and then Jamie is really going to dig into the details of what it means at the programmatic level and really use the Hopkins Early Learning Center as a case study. So early care and education is different from K-12 education in that parents pay for more than half of the cost through tuition and fees. They pay about 52% of the total. This is a national level set of data. The public sector picks up about 46% and the private sector just about 2%. And as you heard from Dr. Sojourner last week, we ask parents to pay the most when they have the least ability to pay. The investment that's made by all of these sources together is still less than what's needed for a high quality early care and education system. So the gap is represented in this graph by that white part of the funnel. We as a society have consistently underinvested in early care and education, and that's led to inadequate funding, a lack of harmonization among the funding streams, which is all those colored lines depict kind of the different funding streams going to all different programs. And this lack of funding streams was also well documented in the 2018 report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, talking about all of the different programs with different eligibilities and constituencies and financing streams. And so this graph just really shows that in a visual way. Also on this graph, those little gray children are those that are left out entirely of the early care and education system, either because there's no slots or because the ones that are available are not affordable.
Ms. Andrews, can you just clarify that those are families that would want this care and education are not receiving it? Or does it, I assume there'd be some families that would choose not to be part of the system, and that's perfectly fine, right? Is this encompassing them, or is it just those who want to but aren't able to?
Mr. Chair, this graph is in those gray children are the ones whose parents would like them to be someplace while they're pursuing education or employment, but they just don't have access. So the public investment in early care and education is uneven. You've heard in this committee over the past several weeks about the return on investment in early care and education, and how that return on investment is highest in those earliest years when children's brain growth is really exploding. This graph is based on the work of our financing team members, Dr. Aaron Sojourner and Rob Grunewald from the Federal Reserve of Minneapolis. And I've been doing this work for 5 years, and I found this graph really quite surprising, where you see kind of where the investment is going. So this in this graph, low income means up to 185% of the federal poverty level. The moderate income is from 185 to 300% of the federal poverty level, and higher income is above 300%. And it shows that most of Minnesota's investment, and that includes the federal dollars that come from the feds, as well as the value of tax credits, goes to low income 3- and 4-year-olds. So about a little over 80% of those low income 3-year-olds have their needs met. And you can see that infants and toddlers, a little over 30% of that need is met. But that doesn't even begin to cover the total cost of care. And there's just a small level of investment in moderate and higher income, with more of that investment going to support 3- and 4-year-olds. Again, this investment is not necessarily consistent with what we know about the science of brain development and the necessity to invest as early as possible. So we wanted to show you what this looks like for families, and I wanted to pull data that was relevant to the committee. So based on Representative Bennett's question that Representative Pinto just mentioned, I decided to look at Freeborn County, the county that Representative Bennett represents. So the median household income in Freeborn County is a little over $53,000 a year. This is slightly above the federal poverty level for a family of four, or above 200% of the federal poverty level. So then I looked at a family scenario where they have a preschooler as well as an infant. So center-based costs in Freeborn County will run this family approximately $19,900 per year. For this family with median household income, childcare would consume 37% of their income. The federal threshold definition of affordability for childcare costs is 7% of family income. So obviously this scenario is widely unaffordable and not workable. Center-based care generally costs more than licensed family care. So what does it look like for if this family were to choose licensed family care?
Ms. Anderson, go back just a second. Yep. Representative Bennett has a question, and since her name has been mentioned several times, I absolutely want to call on her. So Representative Bennett. If you'd rather wait till the end to represent Bennett, we can, but I want to make sure in case you have a clarifying question.
Oops, now am I unmuted here?
Okay. We can hear you, Representative Bennett.
Great, thanks. I would love to ask the questions now. So my first question has to do with the slide, I don't know exactly previous to this, the one that said public investment graph. There you go. And I'm just wondering, does this graph for public investment include universal pre-K costs?
Ms. Anders.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bennett, I believe it does, but I can confirm with our economists on that.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my second question, and maybe you're going to get to this, so if you are, feel free to answer it later, but so the costs in Minnesota for pre-K are higher, from what I understand, than other states. And we know it's expensive for parents. We also know that people who work in the pre-K industry don't make a lot of money. So one of my questions I'd love to get at is, what is different in Minnesota that makes childcare and early childhood education more expensive to do, to operate, than in other states? Because there just seems to be a gap there in what it costs to do business in Minnesota for childcare versus other states. Why is it so expensive for parents, but why aren't the workers making a lot? So that's kind of the question I have, and you may be going to get at that later, so feel free to answer that later. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bennett. Yeah, Ms. Anders, I'm thinking it probably does make sense to hold that till the end, anything that you want to, I'm kind of thinking that might make the most sense, but Ms. Anders?
Representative, or Mr. Chair, Representative Bennett, that's a good question. And I think the presentation will get at some of that. And so we can talk about it at the end. What I want to say is the issues that we are experiencing in Minnesota are consistent across the country. Yes, our costs might be slightly higher than other places, but the broken economic model of early care and education is not unique to Minnesota. It's broken in every state across the country.
And let's make sure, and Representative Ben, let's make sure to get back to your question and explore it some more. But was there something more you wanted to say or ask right now, Representative Bennett?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I'll keep listening. Thanks much. Okay. Very interesting information.
Good. Thank you, Representative Bennett. Yeah, and let's do make sure to circle back to that. So, and members, as you have clarifying questions, please raise your hand as Representative Bennett did, and then otherwise we'll make sure we have plenty of time for questions at the end. So Ms. Anders, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this again, just to bring us back, was the scenario for the family in Freeborn County earning median household income who is looking at licensed family childcare. So in this scenario, the licensed family childcare runs about $13,600. So that's about 25% of this family's income. So it's better, but it's still far from that 7% threshold of affordability. So we know that families are making really hard choices when faced with these kinds of budget realities. In some families, the parents might try and work split shifts. In some families, one of the parents stays out of the labor market to take care of the children. This is often the mother, not always, but the impact often falls on women. Some might have a relative who's willing to watch the children for no or low costs. And some families, when they see these kinds of numbers, choose to have fewer or no children. High childcare costs are one of the top factors contributing to the declining fertility rates in the United States. So you see the impact of this broken economic system is felt at the family level, but it's also at this macro demographic level that this is having real impacts on our society. These options are not really great for family, as they're not really great for our economy. We lose out on the talent and contribution of parents that they can make in the labor market. Households that have only one parent in the labor market have less income, and in some cases, then those families are living close to the poverty level or in poverty. I'd now like to turn this over to Oriane from DEED, who will dig into the details as only a labor market expert can do.
Thank you, Ms. Andrews. Ms. Casella, if you can please identify yourself for the record and then continue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Oriane Cassell. I am the interim director of the Labor Market Information Office at DEED. And I just want to make sure that everyone can hear me, because I know that this morning when we were testing mics, my voice was kind of quiet.
Ms. Cassell, I can hear you quite well.
Thank you.
And I'm seeing a thumbs up from others. Yep.
Thank you. This graph and this slide just kind of slices the information that Krista was presenting by various demographic groups. So as you can see, the high cost of childcare, and this is for center-based care specifically, falls differently on different demographic groups in Minnesota. So the average share of income that families pay for full-time childcare ranges from 13% for white families with a preschool age child, and that's at the median income for white families, and that was data as of 2018. To 44% for Black families with an infant. So obviously infant care is a lot more expensive. Single parents experience the greatest gap in ability to afford care, and that's single parents with a single income. And then family childcare costs are somewhat lower, and if people are interested, I do have that data, but I don't have a slide prepared on it. CCAP, the Minnesota Child Care Assistance Program, does subsidize the cost of care for low-income families, but in July 2020, there were 1,473 families on the waiting list. I think the next slide is mine also. So this is a very, very broad overview of why childcare cost is so expensive. And I should also state that the information I'm presenting today is a summary of an article that we have in our Minnesota Economic Trends magazine from September, and it is on our website, and I will be providing a PDF copy of that after this hearing.
We'll make sure to send that we'll post that to our website and send it to members. Please continue. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if very briefly, and this will go much more in depth into this, why is childcare so expensive in general? 70% of the cost of running a childcare center is in staffing, and that's basically non-negotiable. Like, there is no way around that fact. Part of it is that programs need to comply, obviously, with safety, health, and education regulations, and those include staff ratio and space requirements. 20% of the cost is in facilities and 10% is in other program expenses, curriculum and administrative costs. The other thing to note, and I was actually a little bit surprised to hear this when I heard it at a previous testimony that I attended on this topic, is that it's very hard for centers to reach 100% capacity because children have to move from room to room based from classroom to classroom based on their age and developmental goals. And so space has to be reserved for them. And so it's very hard to figure out a way to run a program at over 85% capacity and still accommodate your current children.
Ms. Cassell, just a question for me about this. I know a lot of our focus, a lot of our examples are going to be from center-based care, but of course we have many, many children in family care, and they do incredible work in our state. Is that true as well? I would think that it would be that that there's most of the cost is in the staffing there. I mean, the person themselves providing the care, and that the margins are similarly very thin. Can you just talk about this perspective from the family care perspective?
Chair Pinto, I don't think I'm the best qualified to talk about that. I don't know exactly where how the costs break down. Later in my slides, there is a summary of a survey that was done of childcare providers who have left the profession recently and why they left. And so I will cover that, I believe. I don't think it's this next slide, but in a future slide.
Okay, thank you. Please continue.
So this slide summarizes, what we all know, which is that childcare workers are low paid. And part of this is a result of that gap between what parents can afford to pay and what it costs to run a childcare center. And again, we'll get much deeper into the costs later in this presentation. But just to look at the wages that workers are paid and how they line up with the cost of living. Median wages for childcare workers are lower than for any other occupation that requires a high school diploma in Minnesota. In terms of requiring a high school diploma, some programs don't require a high school diploma, but on average, our data shows that that most of the hiring that's done in Minnesota does require a high school diploma for childcare workers. So this occupation ranks 36 out of over 450 occupations in terms of current demand, and that was as of second quarter 2020 from our job vacancy survey and our occupations and demand list. And that gives it a 5 out of 5-star rating. The median income for preschool teachers in private centers is lower than the median wage of any other occupation that requires an associate's degree. So the most straightforward way to qualify to be a preschool teacher is to have an associate's degree in early learning or child development. Preschool teachers currently rank in the middle of demand with a 3-star rating, also based on the second quarter 2020 data, and that's really when centers were reeling from the pandemic and probably not doing a lot of hiring. Demand generally ranks a lot higher in this occupation. So, overall, neither childcare workers nor preschool teachers earn enough to meet the basic cost of living for a family of three. And the cost of living is based on our cost of living, Minnesota cost of living, analysis that we have up on our website. We just updated it, actually. It'll be updated this week. So these numbers are from 2020. Let's see. And then preschool teachers. So a childcare worker does not earn at the median wage enough even to support a single person in Minnesota, and preschool teachers just barely meet that threshold and don't earn enough to support a family of three. So this family of three is comprised of one adult working full-time, one adult working part-time, and one child. And that is actually the most typical family structure in Minnesota in terms of the way that people split work. And the $18.20 an hour is an average wage that those two wage earners need to earn. I think I know. I do want to mention one other thing actually on this slide, which is that because of these low wages, DEED has a very hard time supporting childcare programs in terms of workforce development programs, which of course childcare programs are desperately in need of because they have a very hard time finding qualified workers with paying these wages. And the Minnesota Dislocated Worker Program Board has never agreed to fund training in this industry, and the apprenticeship programs in Minnesota have not been able to prioritize these occupations. So that does create, we haven't found a way to really support this industry in terms of the workforce development that's needed.
Ms. Cassell, and the reason for that is because the wages are so low, that's why you can't, those apprenticeship programs are not being pursued? Ms. Cassell?
Correct. The Dislocated Worker Program doesn't have anything in statute that says that they have to focus on higher wage occupations, but that's a decision that the board has made over many years of overseeing the program, that it's very critical to invest in occupations that pay a living wage.
So because this occupation doesn't pay a living wage, it means that almost one in five early childhood educators is living in poverty. The poverty rates for early childhood educators are significantly higher, as you can see in this graph, than they are for K-8 educators, even though they're doing similar work of care and education. And then within the early childhood field, there are compensation disparities that are important to know about. Educators of infants and toddlers make less than preschool teachers. Again, similar work, different levels of compensation. The early childhood workforce, as you know, is made up almost exclusively of women, and disproportionately women of color. Women of color earn less than their white counterparts. African American educators earn on average 78 cents less per hour. The diversity in the early childhood education field is an asset that we should value. The early childhood field is considerably more diverse than the K-12 space, which is great because children in Minnesota are becoming increasingly diverse, and they need and deserve teachers that look like them and that respect their culture. So it's on us to address and dismantle the systemic racism that pays our educators of color even less than their white counterparts. In fact, so many of Minnesota's early childhood educators live in poverty that Minnesota spends $43 million per year in public assistance benefits to support the early childhood workforce. The low compensation and lack of professional supports is hard on early childhood educators and makes it hard for child outcomes to be maximized. Educators who are worried about their own well-being are not as accessible and available to the children in their care. The Center for the Study of Childcare Employment at the University of California in Berkeley is one of the preeminent organizations in the country doing work specifically on the early childhood workforce. And they use their research and policy work to best support the early childhood workforce to ensure young children's optimal development. In 2018, they published this report based on the results of a survey that they did in Minnesota. This study had been done in multiple other states and used as a tool to document teachers' perspectives about workplace conditions that impact their practice and quality. The tool has only been used and validated with childcare centers, but they are working on developing one to use on family childcare. And we hope that when they do that, we can get some grant funding so that we can do this work in Minnesota and look at licensed family child care programs. This original work was grant funded by the Joyce Foundation in part. So it's important work that I want to just show you a few highlights. There's some pretty sobering results. After 10 years, teachers in the survey were making only a little bit over $16 an hour. So 10 years, they made it up to 16 bucks. Again, not enough really to support a family. 38% of them needed some kind of public assistance in order to meet their basic needs. And their circumstances caused most of them to be worried, about paying for healthcare, housing, even food for their own children. You can understand that adults who are worried about whether they are going to be able to feed their own children might not be as present and attentive to others' people's children. The underinvestment in the system leads to this really horrible situation where employers and working parents are dependent on some other working parent being willing to accept poverty-level wages in order for the first set of working parents to be able to go to work. The early childhood workforce is literally subsidizing working families and our economy, and we don't think that's equitable. So, would you choose a career in early care and education? There are many, many wonderful and important things about a career working with young children. It is vastly important work. It is not babysitting. Early care educators do the important work of building the brain architecture of the next generation, supporting social emotional learning, and providing the strong foundation for academic and life success for our youngest children. The achievement gaps that we talk about in K-12, all the way up to completion, high school graduation, those achievement gaps are grounded in the opportunity gaps that exist in early childhood. A strong early childhood foundation is the best way to ensure that a child thrives and succeeds. So it is really important work, but our system sets it up in such a way that it's really hard for people to choose. So I just took a look at two corporations that are in many of our Minnesota communities, Target and Starbucks, and they are paying $15 an hour. Target is currently paying all employees that much, and Starbucks is on path to pay all those in the near future. The employees at these companies get generous medical benefits, dental benefits, retirement, life insurance, paid time off. Starbucks will actually pay for you to get a college degree at Arizona State University through their online college degree program. And you get a free pound of coffee every week at Starbucks, and at Target, you get a 10% discount. And there's no degree, no post-secondary degree requirement. Early childhood, on the other hand, has much lower wages, fewer benefits, fewer paid time off, no fancy perks, and you might very well be paying off student loans. So while we all love our Target runs and our lattes, the care and education of children is such an important job, but we don't value it in the way that it needs to be valued.
So this slide, this graph is from the SLED system, if you're familiar with that. It is the population of graduates of early learning and child development programs in Minnesota from all Minnesota institutions, public and private, and where they ended up 2 years after graduation within Minnesota. So those who stayed within Minnesota. And it splits out, because you can see the huge differences here, it splits out public school and privately owned programs by the education level within these education programs, early learning and child development. And what this graph shows is that for certificates and associate's degrees, graduates of those programs primarily went into private center-based programs, because that's what these programs require in terms of educational attainment. And they earned very low wages in line with what we saw in the other graph, which was wages of the currently existing workforce. This is wages 2 years after graduation in these programs. And then you can also see, which is really wonderful actually, that bachelor's degree and graduate degree educators are going into the public school system into, you know, largely in this case, probably preschool and possibly some assistant teaching positions in the school system. And they're earning very, very decent wages that pay family supporting incomes. But very, very few are going into private centers at that bachelor and graduate degree level, because the wages are just so low that they don't support people through earning a bachelor's degree and then being able to pay off loans. So this again, this graph and most of the data that I can provide only covers what we call UI unemployment insurance covered jobs, because that's the data that we have at DEED to look at. We don't have a lot of data on the self-employed. But in terms of looking at the family child care providers, there was a survey done very recently of family child care providers who have recently gone out of business. And their concerns were actually more around healthcare benefits. So 40% stated that lack of health insurance was their reason for going out of business, and working conditions, long hours and difficulty finding substitute providers. Low wages was lower on the list. And again, these are self-employed people. So I don't have wages on them specifically, but I think that they're probably from this survey and other work that's been done, I think there is probably a lot of information on earnings for these family child care providers that we could provide after, if that's of interest. And then my last slide is just kind of ties together, you know, why early childhood and education matters for Minnesota. Businesses actually in pre-pandemic, this was, you know, the top, one of the very top concerns that businesses in Minnesota, you know, told DEED that they had. And some of our folks who work with businesses and who work in the community on workforce development and economic development have, you know, formed groups of people who are concerned that include businesses, nonprofits, parents, providers, and are attempting to really try to expand capacity in their regions. Also businesses, we heard testimony last year at a hearing that I attended where businesses were testified what a difficult time they faced in trying to develop childcare programs that met their needs. But why it matters is that about 10% of Minnesota's labor force are parents of children under 6 years old. And we have very high labor force participation rates in this demographic and really across all demographics. But in Minnesota, as we know, the labor force is not growing fast. As a matter of fact, it's barely growing at all. During the pandemic, the labor force has shrunk quite significantly, and we're hoping that that's really very temporary. But that lack of labor force growth and is before the pandemic was largely responsible for holding back our economic growth and our job growth. And post-pandemic is likely to continue to be a problem. And so the higher, the higher the labor force participation rate can be for this particular group of people who are so critical to businesses. This is the group that businesses are absolutely desperate to hire, desperate to train and get experience so that they can move them up in their, in their businesses and in their careers, and to become more productive. This is exactly the group of people that we as a economy can't afford to lose even for short periods of time while they're raising young children.
Ms. Gazelle, I think I'm going to ask you to wrap up if you can. I'm going to ask you to wrap up if you can. I know the second half of the slide, I think that folks, it just could not be more important, that bottom half. And I hope the members of the committee are well aware of it. I do want to make sure to get to Ms. Bonzik and then questions. Is there any just sort of final comment that you have there? But I do want to get moving.
Mr. Chair, I think that summarizes it just fine. Thank you.
Good, and I do want to direct members' attention. I hope that you were, because I was speaking too, that you saw, because the bottom half of the slide is sort of the foundation of everything that we've been doing, and I hope that we've been picking that up in the last few weeks about how critical those early years are and how critical it is the work that's done by the folks in this sector. So, Ms. Cassell, thank you so much. Ms. Bonzik, please identify yourself and then proceed with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, representatives of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Jamie Bonzik. I am the Executive Director of Hopkins Early Learning Center. I have 20 years in the field with experience in publicly funded pre-K, 3 and 3 to 5 year old programming, Head Start and early Head Start experience, and a number of years in the private pay childcare industry. I'm here to talk to you today about Hopkins Early Learning Center. So we're a nonprofit organization in the West Metro, and typically would serve 105 of our 117 licensed childcare slots. Primarily, those are infant and toddler slots. That number of 105 versus the 117 speaks to the intentional under-enrollment of the program to accommodate for the age and developmental moves between classrooms that are needed to accommodate so children can stay in the program, as my colleague at Deed mentioned. We have been NACE accredited since 1986, and we're in the Parent Aware pilot program and remains in the Parent Aware system as a 4-star program through the duration of our existence. 10% of our children are on county subsidies or scholarships that are provided from within the institution. And the numbers that you saw earlier today in Fairborn County are about half of what parents were paying here. So an infant per week, parents were paying $425 per week. For a toddler, $373 a week, and for a preschool child, $303 per week. What those tuition funds paid for were lower than state ratios and 4-year degreed teachers that made a livable wage, of which I'm going to show you. Also, our organization paid healthcare contributions, this long-term disability insurance, retirement, some of the things that Krista had mentioned earlier about target workers getting, we ensured that our staff were treated with professional integrity. So Krista, if you could switch the slide, what I'm going to show you is our basic 2019-2020 budget pre-COVID. COVID did a whole number on the break-even analysis, but even before the pandemic, we anticipated making a whopping $975. So on the left-hand side, you will see our expenses. So our expenses in payroll, we paid about 79% of our budget in wages and benefits, and that was due to a subsidized lease. So that included health insurance and retirement costs, which you can see Our subsidized lease, our facility, was at $6 a square foot, which is about a third of what market rate is. We pulled money every year from our reserves to pay for scholarships, for wraparound, for things that children and families really couldn't afford, but there was no other entity beyond philanthropy that would pay for those. And looking at training and quality improvements, classroom materials, food, marketing and recruitment, most of that going into workforce. So if we had a teacher who, you know, did leave, trying to find a new teacher is actually quite expensive. We have to have healthcare consultants. And then as a very small nonprofit, we would also have to pay for other consultants that we don't have on staff, like IT. And then as a nonprofit, we also have to pay to be audited every single year. And then what you'll see at the last line item is cleaning supplies. And that's what our anticipated budget was. If you look on the other side, what you see is we don't have a lot of revenue sources. The majority of that comes from parents and some of that from early learning scholarships, from CCAP, from Child and Adult Care Food Program, which is under the USDA. And then our fundraisers included things like go to Chipotle and they'll give us a small percentage, or mini grants from Think Small for improvements on multicultural classroom materials. And then we would have some general donations from things like Give to the Max Days. But that is our budget. And I would not say the only thing that you're gonna see when we move to the next slide is that a lot of other programs are working with a non-subsidized lease space. So in our costs, the programs that you might see that have subsidized leases are going to be programs oftentimes that are aligned with a CHEERS, and then they needed to reclaim that space for their own purposes and expanding public pre-K options. But Krista, if you would move to the next slide, we can talk about when we looked at moving to a market rate. So market rate facilities in a commercial market are anywhere between $18 a square foot and $32 a square foot, depending on where you are. So the rate we used here was 18. And what you can see is if we were gonna keep, in order to make the livable wage payments to invest in retirement and paid days off and time out of the classroom for teachers and professional development days and the things that contribute to long-term teachers, our teachers had been with us for the majority more than 10 years, but a good chunk of them more than 20 years. That comes from good working conditions. And what you'll see is if we had to pay a market rate lease, we would be at a loss of $281,000 a year. And there's no way to recover that. There's no amount of philanthropy that's going to cover that cost. And so, Krista, if you could move to the next slide, what you can see here is again that majority of our funding, Oriane had mentioned earlier that a typical facility is or organization is paying 70%. Like I said, we are at 79-80% in our staffing costs. And again, that leads to long-term teachers. And when it comes down to brain development, why does that matter? Because long-term teachers lead to better relationships. Relationships are what form neurosynapses in children. It creates better attachment. It creates stability and safety, which leads to academic gains, because the way that the brain is built, it needs to be in a safe environment in order to flourish. If we get to the market rate and you see that we would only be able to spend 67% of our budget, those low wages is what highly contributes to turnover, which is not good for child development, and it's not good for an organization, because you're constantly paying like $5,000 to $8,000 per person every time you're having to replace a person, train them, onboard them, and get them accustomed to the organization's company culture. So if Krista, if you could go. So what happened in our organization, like I mentioned briefly, is that we were asked to rehome. Our lease was going to be terminated. And when we did the budget and we looked at that market rate, we would go from a little bit over $17 an hour as a median income for our staff to $9 an hour. And there's absolutely no way that you can cut a 20-year veteran teacher's salary down to $9 an hour. And to that extent, when I got my first job as an early childhood educator, I had a 4-year degree in early childhood education, a teaching license, and I made $10.25 an hour, which is more than this. And I could not afford to pay both my health insurance and my student loans. So if it was briefly mentioned, but student loans for an early childhood educator, it is the lowest return on investment of all 4-year degree professions. You make the least, even though you have the same cost coming out as a person with an engineering 4-year degree. And so it is not possible to pay somebody with that amount of expertise $9 an hour and retain them. They would all go out the door. And so after looking at, you know, 5 different case scenarios, ultimately, if Krista, you could go to the next slide, we looked and looked, but we weren't able to find a turnkey facility with the same community investment of the $6 a square foot. And so ultimately, our board of directors voted to close Hopkins Early Learning Center. Our last day of serving children and families was December 18th. And at this time, I remain the only employee, and that is to wind down the organization from a legal and financial perspective. And it was as depressing as you could think of a job to have during a pandemic, to have to rehome. At the end, we had 21 teachers, and you know, those 105 families had, you know, been cut in half because of COVID and protocols of keeping everybody safe, but it was still 60 families that needed to find a new organization to take care of them and their children. Next slide, please. Okay, so this is what I briefly mentioned. No turnkey facility. Why couldn't we just like pop up somewhere else? Because we were unable to find a space that allowed us to keep our business model and to serve children. And really every single community that we talked to, the need for affordable childcare was something that had been identified and nobody was able to figure out how to fund. And again, with COVID, our increased cost of 57%, our enrollment down by 50%, and just we were not able to connect with people, even if they understood that early childhood education and care is important, that it's important for the economy, that it's important for the children. The lack of understanding the early childhood finances and the lack of infrastructure just made it impossible for us to continue as an organization. So Krista, if you'll go to the next slide. So ultimately, what have we lost here? Our organization would employ on a given year, you know, upwards of 28 teachers. At the end, we had 21 experienced staff because we had to lay some people off or they had to leave to take care of their own families, and 117 slots. Again, I mentioned over 50% of our programming was infants and toddlers. That is the most in demand and the least. Krista mentioned infants and toddler teachers typically make less. Our infant and toddler teachers made on par with their preschool staff here and in the building, on par with some people in a public school program. And so those people all had to disseminate into other organizations. And then this is my last slide. So ultimately, what are the societal impacts? So in early childhood education and care, I think we've covered that there's unequal access, specifically in infant and toddler care, and that those gaps in care lead to achievement and I would say other health related costs downstream. The triple bottom line is not fully realized for children, families, and our community. To children and families, it goes into their long-term health and development and success. For the business economy, what we'll have is disproportionately more women who are not able to work. And to that point, I think in broader society, one of the things that we have, and I recently listened to a podcast from the Center for Workforce Development out at Berkeley, is that we're pitting women against women. So we're pitting the women who work in low wage jobs to raise or to support the development of other women's opportunity to go to work. And so we're just seeing a variety of things. It's very hard to have a team approach when we haven't laid the foundation out for everybody to be successful. And so that concludes my my presentation, and I know that we're going to open up for questions.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Bonzik. Thank you so much. Thanks to all three of our presenters. I'll just note the Hopkins Early Learning Center, I know, did just amazing work, and it really is a loss to our to that community. And then, and I really appreciate you being willing to sort of open your books up and allow us to see. I want to emphasize to members that, you know, this was a organization that was operating not-for-profits, that was relying, it really jumped out at me that were several thousand dollars in donations coming in. That's even how you even had the $975 positive balance. And of course, that was then with a several hundred thousand dollars subsidized rent in the church as well. So it would just that I hope starts to answer our questions for folks. But let's move on to some questions and see if folks have that. Please do raise your hand, questions or comments. Many of those presenters. I want to, just to start, I want to get back to Representative Bennett's question then, making sure to, so first of all, just to compare our state with others as to how, and I know we probably don't have data right at hand. Ms. Andrews, you started to answer that, but how do these trends compare with other states and cost in Minnesota with other states? And can you start to answer that? And then Representative Bennett, will turn to you to ask any follow-up questions from your original question.
Mr. Chair and members, I've received some information from one of my colleagues at Child Care Aware of Minnesota to help me answer this question. So she points out that Minnesota's costs are not necessarily among the highest. We are among the highest for center-based costs, but in the bottom quarter for costs for licensed family child care. And because we have so many child care centers and few centers, the centers that are kind of, they do cost more. So it, when you average things out, it gets a little bit different. But so, you know, some high costs, some low costs. And then our cost of living in the metro for other things compared to other metro areas of the state is also high. And there is a cost of care report that DHS did that we can make available to the committee that also answers some of these questions.
Ms. Andrews, just and Representative Bennett, please feel free to hop on in. I'm just as a follow up on that, that I'm seeing, that I'm thinking. So, can you just talk about why is it that the center based care is more expensive, or is it? Are you alluding to the fact that the cost of living in many ways is higher, at least in the metro, and you've got many more centers in the metro? Can you just talk about that,
Mr. Chair? That's my understanding.
Okay. Good. Yeah, and members, please feel free to raise hands with any questions or comments about anything that we've been seeing. But so, Ms. Andrews, just to Representative Bennett, I see you're unmuted. Let's call on you. Yeah, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, you asked the very question I was going to ask: is why are our centers more expensive on the whole than other states? And it would be interesting, you know, if it is cost of living, kind of trying to identify what is it that we are doing as a state that's driving up this cost of living. And there obviously there's other factors we need to deal with as well, aside from the differences in our state and other states. But I think that's one we could look at as we also look at other options. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bennett. I think that our state has a higher income than other states as well. I think that part of our higher cost of living is that in general we're a higher income state than some other comparable states. And so I think cost of living associates with that. I'm not sure if any of our presenters would have any insight into Representative Bennett's question at all beyond what I've said. Ms. Andrews, I see that you're on mute, or Ms. Cassell.
Chair, members of the committee, Representative Bennett, I'm just looking at data on Minnesota's preschool teacher wages versus US wages. Our preschool teacher wages are quite a bit higher, at the median. $17.64 an hour versus $14.82 an hour for the U.S. Now, those aren't exactly the numbers I presented because I was focused on the private sector, and I don't have the private sector numbers for the U.S. in front of me. So some of the skewing here is probably because we have the pre-K and the preschool teachers, the public pre-K, and we might have a higher share of preschool teachers in public pre-K than US wide. But we do seem to, and I don't know if we have the data to do this analysis, but I could look at whether we could do an analysis comparing private center wages in Minnesota versus in the US and see if private centers pay more in Minnesota than in the US. That might be some of the cost difference there.
Thank you, Ms. Cassell. Before I go back to Representative Bennett, I should have noted this earlier that we've been joined by, for quite a bit of this, by Representative Heather Keeler, who's not on this committee, but she's interested in the topic, and as a courtesy, I encourage her to attend if she could. And so we've been really glad to have her. And Representative Keeler, if you have any questions or comments, feel free to raise your hand. But Representative Bennett, we'll go back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just going to make a comment, just kind of an observation, I guess, is one thing that we are dealing with, I believe, is just a societal issue of what we value. You know, when you look as a society, we tend to value the glitzy and exciting things more, like sports and Hollywood. And, you know, there's tons of money poured into that industry. And yet education of our children and the care of our children tends to take a back seat. And that's a sad analysis, but I kind of think it's true. I don't know how we battle that, but it is evident, you know, just from where we invest dollars as a society. Whether we can fix that, probably not, but just an observation.
Representative Bennett, as you said that, I saw a lot of nodding heads. And I guess you made me think about a sentence that I heard Ms. Cassell say, and it felt like it bore repeating because it really jumped out at me, that median wages for childcare workers are lower than for any other occupation that requires a high school diploma. So in terms of where we put our societal, and that really, I have to say, I've been looking at this for a number of years, and that sentence really kind of struck me. It really does say quite a bit. Representative Wasilewicz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, but I've had that exact same thought, Representative Bennett. If every single professional athlete put 10% of their salary towards early childhood in this country, I think we have a ton of money to spend on it. But I think it speaks to the values, but I also think that, the other statistic that stood out to me was the return on investment for a degree in early childhood is also one or the lowest of four-year degrees. So we're asking people to take on a burden of getting a four-year degree, and then we're essentially saying, but we're not going to pay you very well, and you have to figure out how to deal with that sort of on your own, or, you know, get public assistance or other assistance to try and make ends meet for themselves and their families. And I think I keep coming back to this idea that we're essentially saying the most important part for children, the most important part of their lives, and the people who are responsible for helping care for children in the most important part of their lives are not worth it. They're not worth having good wages and good benefits when they're doing some of the most important work that we have, right? We're setting children up for success in those first 3 years of life. I think that one of the statistics that I saw that really sort of, I know all the statistics, but one of the things that I really found striking was the statistic that 90% of your brain is 90% of adult size by the time you're five, right? So I can't get over the fact that we still, as a state, as a society, as a country, we know that those are the most important years of a child's life, and yet we don't invest in that. And I still find it hard to believe for all of the conversations we have around, wanting to make wise investments and with state and federal funds, that we still are so far behind other states, but also other countries in the sort of investment they have in these couple of years. So just want to make a few comments there. And I sort of see all the conversations around high turnover. I work in a school-based child care program outside of the legislature, and we have the same issue. We have a really, really hard time finding staff. I was just looking through some job openings that are just in my local school district, and there's a ton of them because it's a hard group to find. Wages are super low. There aren't any benefits, and I think it's going to continue to be a struggle. And I think we're going to continue to see people foregoing having children because they can't find one of the big reasons not being able to find affordable childcare. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Wasilewicz. Ms. Anders, or maybe Ms. Cassell, so we heard this one example from Hopkins Early Learning Center, and you talked about the overall context, and we saw that example. How common is that? Is that fiscal squeeze for early care learning providers? Like basically, are the numbers that we're seeing there recognizing you've got a particular investment in quality, which we want, but sort of how comparable can we think about that in terms of what's going on around our state? And again, in answering Representative Bennett's question about, you know, why is it that you've got parents paying such a huge part of their income and folks receiving such low wages, and yet I guess it seems to me that the numbers just don't add up. But can you talk about that, perhaps, Ms. Anders?
Mr. Chair and members, the story of the Hopkins Early Learning Center is illustrative of very many other programs across Minnesota. It's not unique that a program is operating with, you know, we say razor thin margins. They are razor thin margins. I remember working on a statewide study 20 years ago and figuring out that programs are making pennies in profit, profit or net assets, because many of them are nonprofit. It was razor thin then, it's even more razor thin now. And what we're experiencing in Minnesota is not unique to Minnesota. It is happening across the country. So we can certainly focus on some of the questions about how we compare, but this is not unique to Minnesota. That's not gonna be our problem, you know, deciding that we're gonna be like some other state. No other state has really figured this out. We have underinvested as a society. I've got one graph that Representative Pinto has seen where we look at the investment that the United States has made compared to the investments of other industrialized countries. And it's, you know, it starts out on one end with the Scandinavian countries that invest around 3% of their GDP in early care and education. And the United States is second to the last in terms of these countries. We simply don't invest.
Thank you, Ms. Anders. That's really helpful context. Representative Katiza Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I just have a follow-up question for Ms. Bonsack. We had the opportunity to chat one-on-one last year, but I had to step away for a moment when you were talking about the subsidized rent versus market rate rent. And I'm wondering if you can just kind of talk about that again. Now, am I remembering correctly that your rent was subsidized through the school district and I missed maybe, or maybe you didn't mention it, but is that something that, you know, how much percent, how many providers actually have that opportunity to kind of like pay a lower than market rate rent in real life?
Ms. Monzik.
Chair, Representative. So our lease price at $6 a square foot is common in church-based programs, in some programs that are in public schools. We will also find programs that are in churches and schools that pay nothing. And so and other organizations that might subsidize a rent are like healthcare centers. For an example, my understanding is that the YWCA Child Care Center operates and can pay and can offer some different things around tuition as the result of their location, but they can't expand to meet the need even though they have a high quality program, because if they move outside of their facility, they can't do that. Pre-pandemic, pre-understanding our lease, we were actually looking at expanding to see if we could serve more of infants and toddlers, because we had an almost 3-year wait list for infant and toddler care. Just to kind of put that into perspective, what that means is typically women are calling a child care the day they're pregnant to get into a program. this leads to more academic disparities between families on CCAP because they can't actually get in because those wait lists are so full unless those spots are bought out. So I know it's a little bit more than what you asked on, but I think that it speaks to the overall issue of problems.
Ms. Bozic, I'm having, yeah, sorry, the your sound, I think you were just barely, it was, yeah, there's a lot of breaking up. I was able to hear it long enough. I hope that others were too, but it was sort of just barely on the edge. I wonder if maybe would have you try turning your video off. Maybe the connection will be better or something, or maybe it's, I hope that folks, at least I was having a little bit of trouble there. I don't know if I can see other folks nodding as well. I think that we did get all that. I'll go back to Representative Fatisa Witoon, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that response, Ms. Bonsic. I appreciate you perhaps repeating yourself since I had to step away. So it would seem to me, and perhaps there's some other data that someone may be able to get for the committee, but for corporations who are able to have on-site childcare for parents who work there, for employees, or even if there was like a sort of like a neighborhood public-private partnership in which, like, you know, subsidizing rent might just be, you know, the tiny bit of relief that some of our childcare providers need in order to earn a little bit more profit and then be able to kind of raise wages and that sort of thing. That, you know, that might be something that if it's not happening on a frequent basis, maybe we can further conversations on that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Witoon. I wonder if, one thing I'll just observe, Representative Witoon, is that even with that several hundred thousand dollar subsidized rent, right, the Hopkins Early Learning Center had a $975 positive balance, and that was with several. So I mean, that's a challenge. I don't know if Ms. Anders, if you have any comment about that sort of idea from Representative Katisa Witoon, and then we've got a couple other members I'll turn to.
Mr. Chair and members, all I would say is, we'll look into it and we'll see if we can find data on how many programs are receiving some support that makes their program able to cash flow, which is really what this is. I think what it does point to is there are solutions, and there's probably system level solutions that you could consider that would make it more likely for other organizations to contribute to the overall costs and make it more possible for these programs to cash flow. Because right now these programs, many of them can't cash flow without kind of that something. And we're not gonna Chipotle fundraise our way out of this. Like, we need more systemic level interventions.
Thank you, Ms. Andrews. So we're gonna go to Representative Dabney and then Representative Pryor. So Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and lots to think about here. So I think I can get to a question. but the question will be, it seems like we have two interrelated issues here. One is the business viability, pardon me, of the childcare centers. The other is the economic viability of the childcare center staff. And I guess my editorial comment would be, from looking at some of the graphs, it seems that something like the public option for Minnesota Care would be a way to demonstrate, as Representative Bennett talked about, what do we prioritize? And having a process that would allow people to buy into a public option for healthcare might be a way that would function essentially in this setting as a business subsidy to childcare centers, because they would be able to offer childcare at a reasonable rate, or their staff would be able to. But maybe the question to the presenters is, am I right about there being kind of a dual track challenge here, the centers and the staff?
I'll call on any of the, I see Ms. Anders, and we'll call on you first.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, I think you did a great job of summarizing the two issues, the viability of the programs and then the viability really of the career. Having a public option for Minnesota Care, again, it's a more systemic response to helping boost up the industry and make it so that it would cash flow. I think back to the slides that Ms. Bonsic showed, they were contributing $60,000 for healthcare. So, you know, that would take a small portion of their budget out not a huge, it's not going to have a huge difference, $60,000 on the $1.5 million budget. Mm-hmm. It would help more impact maybe at the individual staff level of mm-hmm. of having them, you know, not have to go without health insurance, which is what many of them are doing. So it's, I think it's a systemic level response that's worth looking at, but it won't fix the whole problem. Like, it's just, we probably need 10 or 15 systemic level responses mm-hmm. because the business model just doesn't work right now.
And I should note, I think Ms. Bozic wanted to respond as well. If I should, Representative Dabney, I'll have her dive sure. in if she wants to and come back to you. Yeah, Ms. Bozic.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Ms. Okay, Bonzi. Great. I think that is a great point that Representative Dabney pointed out, that they're both business issues and staff level issues. So some of the way that we fund child care typically is in a price per child, and with the heavy majority of that being paid by parents in the state of Minnesota in a private pay system. But what that does from a business perspective is that you can't provide for stability for your program, right? Like, you can't hire in a new teacher if you know that you're going to need, because your everyday balance is on how many children are currently here, not how many children you might be able to serve if you had another teacher. So there are some of these other systemic ways in the lack of infrastructure that go a little bit broader than the health insurance that we're speaking of, that create better outcomes for kids. So some of the reasons that I think that we see positive things in a public pre-K system is that the pre-K is a system. It already exists. When we look at childcare, there is no system of infrastructure. Again, it's just that, like, every day, if a child can get in, they pay tuition for those days that they are there. And so I think we do need to address that business level to provide more stability for programs to be able to make the decisions that they need in the best interest of children. And while I have the floor, if it's okay, Mr. Chair, I would like to go back to the question raised by Representative Bennett on Please. Costs in Minnesota and just offer Please. My insights. Please. So both the parent aware, oh, thank you. Parent Aware and NACI have a identifying high quality programs for parents. Like, what should parents be looking for when they're shopping? And the things that make a high quality center per those definitions are things like lower ratios, benefits to staff. And when programs are offering those, the cost of tuition is higher. So I think that there might be some of the quality pieces that we are asking for and that do impact that staff level health and wellness that go into that tuition that is higher in Minnesota, is that we're attempting to do that, but we're attempting to do this per child on the family paying that difference and not society. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bonzik. I'm sure Dabney, any follow up for you on any of that?
No, thank you, Ms. Bonzik. Thank you, Ms. Anders. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thanks, Representative Dowdy. So Representative Fryer, and then we'll go to Representative Bolden. Representative Fryer.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I just wanna start by, you know, addressing Ms. Bonsick, that I'm just so sad. It's hard to even go on after that disheartening news that, you know, here's a great center that really served children and served families and served the community and was so valuable to us, and we let it go. And so just really hard. And so thank you for the work that you've done. And, you know, let's hope that that's like the low point and that somehow we turn this around, because I think we do have that opportunity, that there is this reset of what's happened to our lives and our work lives and our families because of the pandemic. That there's, I think it's the time where people are, you know, getting a different look at what their priorities are. So, you know, maybe we can just say, you know, just make that, to be resolved that we can do better in the future. I appreciate this committee, Mr. Chair, and everybody that's participating, because I think that, you know, now, especially this is our second round at this, and that we're building on what we learned and a deeper understanding of our first, you know, the first session that we had this legislative cycle of the 2 years, and now we're coming back to the same thing, and just how important it is to really understand the underlying problem. And the underlying problem, as Chair Pinto has said, as our testifiers have said, is the model does not work. And it's because of inherent, it's not people's choices. It's not about, you know, one value set over another. It's because you can't have more than one adult taking care of four babies, you know? it's just inherent that that's what children need to be safe, to be stable, and to be nurtured. And that's what we're talking about, is we're talking about what a child care setting is, whether it's a family or it's a center or it's a family-based home care. I mean, inherent in that is what we're doing. We're keeping kids safe. We're giving them stability in their lives, and we're nurturing them. And it's, that takes resources. And the families that we're asking these resources of don't have it. And we establish that through an economic model. They don't have the resources. And then right now, a lot of our system is built on the people that are providing this care, the teachers, the early learning teachers. And also, you know, they don't have the resources either. You know, we don't have this population of people that don't need money. We don't have that population. They need to earn a living wage too. So we have this model that we've created in this country that's different from other developed countries in the world, where the ends don't meet. And there's this big gap. And if you have a way of subsidizing that gap, you can struggle on and be successful. And that's kind of our Hopkins model. They had subsidized rates, and they had enough fundraising that they always kept that margin on the positive end instead of the negative end. And then they lost it. And then we lost that whole center. So, you know, I think we're digging in. You know, I think that we're identifying the problem and beginning to try to think, like, systematically, how can we fix this? And then that's where it's like, everybody come on and bring your ideas and you know, let's sort this out and let's make a difference. So just, I guess I don't have a question in that, but I I'm really glad to be on this committee. I'm glad that Representative Keeler is also joining us today and as part of the discussion. And I hope we just keep sharing this discussion with our colleagues of what it is that we're trying to do here and why we believe that it is so important. Thank you,
Representative Pryor. Thank you, Representative Pryor. Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to all the presenters today for this really important and sobering and eye-opening information. It strikes me, we talked last week, as Chair Pinto referenced, that we ask the most of parents when they have the least. And as I'm hearing this, I'm thinking about how we are asking the most of our childcare workers in this time, you know, that is critically important. They are building our future with our, you know, little ones. We know that 0 to 3 is so important. We are asking the most of these folks and providing them the least. You know, the slide of how the percentage of childcare providers who are on, you know, SNAP benefits and receiving those benefits that just, are not able to make ends meet, is really striking. And so, as has been said, I think that goes back to values and priorities and where are we placing our investments. And clearly we are not investing enough in the right places and spaces. And so I think it also bears repeating that the folks that are doing this critically important work are largely women and often women of color. I think that is notable. So clearly work to do. And I would ask Ms. Anders, you referenced in speaking about the healthcare options and Minnesota Care Buy-In option that, you know, that's one systemic thing. And, you know, when we need many more, I'm wondering if you have a wish list of those systemic things, items that you feel, would be helpful in this space.
I know Ms. Anders well enough to know that she's thrilled to have the question asked. So Ms. Anders, please.
Representative Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Bolden, thank you for that question. Yeah, I do have a wish list. My team and I have been coming up with a variety of different things. You know, we need to invest a lot more money. We need to implement Power to the Profession, which is a national framework that would elevate the profession. We have developed a corresponding salary scale that goes along with the levels in Power to the Profession that would start to build the compensation parity with the K-12 workforce. We need to vastly invest in higher education so that people can access the credentials that they would like to have, that the children in their care would benefit from. We need to invest in that whole educational pipeline. We actually need to invest in the faculty level. We're going to run out of PhD level faculty to teach the next generation of early care providers. What's happening right now, just like Oriane Cassell talked about how Dee doesn't want to invest in apprenticeship programs, higher education doesn't want to invest in early childhood programs because they are also evaluated on the salaries of their graduates. So they don't want to have programs where people come out and make poverty level wages. So we've got early childhood programs that are closing in institutes of higher ed. And that's exactly the opposite of what we need to have. Ms. Cassell has estimated that in the next decade, we need to generate 55,000 new early childhood educators. Well, you're not going to do that unless you increase compensation and you have a higher education system that can generate that level of qualified educators. Right now, we're producing about 1,000 bachelor's degreed early childhood people a year. That's simply not enough to meet the demand. So that would, you know, so investing in the profession, investing in higher education, doing a lot of these work, this work at the systems level. We've got a 12-year plan. I'm happy to share more with you about that. That's kind of my high-level overview of my wish list.
All right, Representative Bolden, looks like no follow-up from you. Okay. Members, when Representative Bennett asked her question last week, I think she's really asking on behalf of all of us when she asked about the economics of early care and learning. And I hope that we all now have some really good insights from these presenters and feel the work that we're doing into that economics, and then we can use that to craft solutions. I really want to work with everybody on the committee to do that. Ms. Anders, Ms. Cassell, and Ms. Bonzik, in particular, thank you so much for your work and for the presentation, and eager to work with you on solutions as well. So with that, members, thank you so much, and we will, on Thursday, we're going to dive into some programs related to early care and learning, in particular child care programs operated by DHS, and continue with that. And with that, thank you so much, members. We are adjourned.